Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is my lovely, wonderful co-host of the 2023 year, Mr. Spencer. Not a baby in a top hat, but the old man Williams. I don't know what New Year's
I don't understand why that went on for so long, and I don't appreciate being called an old man.
Now, although you're always like, oh, we're old. Like, no.
We are old.
You know what? Stop it.
Death comes for us all.
Oh, my God. Speaking of, we also... with us. We renewed her contract for another year, and she is in negotiations with HR in terms of her name. Apparently, she's starting her own Twitter campaign. That is intern for now, / everything else, etc. Amy.
I am Death, which I take that as a compliment after seeing, you know, Guillermo's Pinocchio. Death was really nice, Sphinx. I'm okay with that. Yeah.
Anyways, so we are in the new year of 2023, and we have a lot of exciting things down the way. We'll be talking about that in a second, as well as some of the highlights we'll be looking forward to. But we got something in store for you today. And before we do, Spencer, give us them opening credits.
Tune in each and every Wednesday morning on all your favorite streaming platforms and over on our website at filmlosophers.com. Also, connect with us on the social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101.
That's right. We are on the interwebs. You can catch us at our website at filmlosophers.com. We got everything from action, comedy, romance, suspense, anime, everything. You can check it out. If you're looking for it, we got it. Check us out over there on the website, filmlosophers.com. You can also check us out wherever podcasts are streaming, whether if it's iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, TuneIn, iHeart. You can tune into your heart's desire, or Pandora, too. I don't know if I said Pandora. You can tune into your heart's desire and check us out on any of those apps. Give us a follow. Give us a subscribe. Let us know how we're doing. Give us a 5-star review. We've earned it. We have. Social links at the end of the show. It is the new year, folks. We are in 2023. I think we've surpassed every previous movie in the last century that has talked about the future. because I think what was the year for Back to the Future?
That was 2015.
We're in the future now. Flying cars and all that.
Nobody needs a flying car.
Hey, you never know.
No. Do you want people, as they drive now, flying through the air? Through the air. All of a sudden, you're just making yourself some dinner. Next thing you know, someone's Honda is coming crashing through your roof.
That's why you keep it to one story.
That's the way you act like that's going to save you.
I love how this conversation is going, and Amy is fiercely typing on her phone. Apparently, negotiations are still going into the wee hours of the evening.
No, there's a movie, and all I can remember is I think it's Burt Reynolds in a red Speedo with two bandoleros that are red takes place in 2023. And that's where you're like, we have surpassed all. I was like, no, there are movies that are set in 2023.
Burt Reynolds is
Are
you talking about Zardoz?
Yes.
Zardoz. I have not heard that name in a while.
Also, Avengers Endgame takes place in 2023.
That's correct.
Bring It On, Cheer or Die takes place in 2023.
Okay, so let's kind of come back to this conversation.
Carnage,
since you decided
Gemini
to take
Rising,
your little time on your phone
the
over there.
Purge Anarchy.
Doesn't technically WandaVision take place in 2023?
Texas Chainsaw Massacre does as well.
The new one? Because obviously not the old one.
crazy.
In terms of this new year, this year is coming out with a lot of new and unique films. But I think one of the biggest things to look at for this year is either remakes or sequels to films that have not seen sequels in a long time. And of course, you have the obvious hype trains of Marvel, of Conversations of DC. So this is actually a piece of a much larger conversation, but I kind of wanted to get the idea of the table here and see where everybody is sitting at in terms of what are two of the most anticipated movies for you guys. Excuse me. The juice is making me burp. Of what are the two most anticipated movies for you guys that you're looking forward to in the year 2023? I want to start with Amy, and I want to do it one at a time. So I want Amy, do one, and Spencer will do one, and I'll do one, and then we'll move on to the next one. And that doesn't mean, Amy, you say, well, this is my one, but I also wanted to say this one, but I also wanted to say that one. I think we have a history on this show where you take advantage of your whoopsies and you continue with your conversation.
Take advantage of my whoopsies. Yes. If that is the way we're starting off 2023, I know, that's right? That's a very adorable way to be like, aw, shucks, Amy. So I tried to not take any of the big heavy hitters this year or this coming year that I'm excited for, save for one, which is coming out in November. I'm really excited for Dune Part 2. That's November. I think it's like November 2nd that's on the slate.
It's November 3rd.
I was close. But yeah, I really enjoyed the first one. I'm really excited to see the part two, the completion of this first one.
I'm sorry, what? Did you say completion?
Of the first part of this section of the story.
It's not the completion of the first part. There's like eight books.
And who's going to be directing after this one? Because it's not Villeneuve anymore.
This is your choice. Why are you asking me?
Because you're looking at me funny.
Well, because the whole entire
oopsies.
The whole book series is like 13 books long. Yeah. It stopped. Frank Herbert actually finished, I think, the last novel in the series like in like 2008, 2007. I forget.
I'm excited for the completion of Villeneuve's run, which is the part two for Dune that's coming out in November.
So who's taking over after him?
I have no idea.
So he's publicly stated he's not doing any more after two. Oh, this is going to be a short-lived trilogy.
Yep.
Spencer, what is one of your choices for the year 2023 with movies?
One that got pushed from last year that I was really upset about and is now for June. But I'm fine with it if it makes it a better movie. And that's Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse.
Yes.
The first one was just so amazing in just its art department alone without even getting into the story that I'm just excited to see more movies in that style. Also, the trailer dropped for it, and if you haven't seen it, check it out because it looks like it's going to be bonkers.
It's literally a visual Easter egg, like a trailer full of Easter eggs for every comic book fan out there. Everyone who's ever seen the animated series, any of the other series, any other comic book version of Spider-Man from every variant to everything that you've ever seen of Spider-Man, there's a hint of it in this trailer as well as the posters that released. I have to say it's really interesting for the fact that this, out of all the things that Sony has done, this is probably the best kind of entry into the Marvel Cinematic Universe overall.
You mean not Morbius?
Oh my God.
It's Morbin time.
Both of you need
Jesus. Yeah.
No.
Call that one too.
That's good. Like, I feel like this movie, it's odd that their animated film is honestly probably one of the best films that Sony has put out in the last two decades. Plain and simple, not only was it groundbreaking in its storytelling, but it was also extremely unique for its graphic work and the CG in it. You know?
Yeah, the crazy thing is, like, I saw that movie. I was like, where the heck were all the people working on this thing before? Why has Sony not been able to do, like, this level of quality of movies, like, previous to this?
To put it into perspective, the studio that did Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is the same studio who did the Emoji Movie.
Yeah,
Sir Patrick Stewart as the poop emoji was not worth it. Tell you that much.
That movie just hurts me in so many ways.
I've never seen it, and I still refuse to.
You've never seen what?
The Emoji Movie.
Oh, okay.
I refuse.
I haven't seen it either.
Good, we're safe.
On principle.
Excellent.
So, my one of my anticipated movies of the year has got to be, hands down, The final entry into a almost 4-decade-long franchise, and that is Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, dropping June 30th. I feel like there's so much hope that this movie really does well because Kingdom of the Crystal Skull was...
It left something to be desired.
It sucked. And so...
I was using manners, but very well, sir.
I was...
aliens, what?
With elongated skulls. Why did they just call them xenomorphs? That's what they look like.
They were xenomorphs.
Hmm?
What?
What? You can't throw in conspiracy theories like that and not follow up. So this movie has been widely anticipated because of the fact that there's so much care and effort put into it. Harrison Ford himself has mentioned how much time and effort the cast and crew and the director have put into this. What was his name? Ki Kwan?
Yeah. Short round.
Well, yeah, I just don't remember how he's
pronounced. His name is Ki Kwan.
Well, with him coming back into the fray as an actor, one can only hope that they may be able to find room to squeeze him in as like this last opportunity for Short Round. That would just be the best thing ever. Just saying. But I'm anxious to see how they're going to wrap this up because essentially everybody knows, and I believe even the cast and crew are hinting at it, that this will more than likely be Harrison Ford's last hurrah at the Indiana Jones character. So, yeah, I'm super excited for that June 30th. So let's go back to Madam Amy. And what is your second and only second choice for anticipated movies?
I'm going to be ridiculous because this was sneaking past everybody's radar and it is coming out in June and it is an animated picture. Go figure. It's Harold and the Purple Crayon. So there's a book series called Harold and the Purple Crayon that I have loved since I was a little kid. So much so that I have read it to my children. My children have read it. It is about...
To their children?
No, they're not that old.
Just wondering.
Wow, rudeness. but legitimately, it follows this slightly Charlie Brown-headed boy who gets his purple crayon and he draws a way out of his bedroom because he can't sleep and he has all this entire adventure. I'm really excited because I've liked this series forever and nobody's talking about it like at all. And so it's going to be either a sleeper, but it's also coming out during Spider-Man month. So it's going to literally be looked over.
It'll definitely be looked over.
So but I'm excited because I'm a longtime fan, but the likelihood that it'll get a lot of praise and or might be good is very slim.
Well, here's the thing. The theaters, when opening weekend, is going to be filled out with nostalgic parents and teachers are going to try to find a way to get that movie into the classroom. Like, that's literally all the people. Because I know if I was still teaching, I would immediately go to that movie the first opening weekend. And I would look at every single thing I could take and use at work. And then eventually, obviously, bootleg the movie and show it to the kids at school.
Like Lyle Lyle Crocodile.
Yes.
Yes.
Spencer, second and last movie.
My second movie is going to be Creed 3.
Yeah.
I am excited to see Jonathan Majors in this movie because he looks like a beast.
No joke.
Oh my
like
gosh.
That trailer, that I'm not saying that I am attracted to Jonathan Majors.
You are. It's okay.
But
we all are.
If there was a male specimen on this planet that could pull me to the other team, I'm just saying, Jonathan Majors, you are given the task because that man is
fine. Fine.
That man is fine. I was like
I'm
looking
sorry,
out.
I'm blushing
like,
now.
And when I grow up, I want to be Jonathan Majors.
He looks so good in this movie. And I don't think any of it was for, like, in preparation of Kang. I feel like everything he did was focused on this role. Mm-hmm. And he looks... Like, this is the mirror kind of image of what you got out of Rocky 3 with Clubber Lang. And Mr. T was just so beefed up. And by the end of that movie, when you had the rematch with Rocky and Clubber Lang, they're both just like swole, massive people. And that's what you see out of this. Like, you see this character whom we have seen in movies like The Last Black Man in San Francisco. We've seen him in several other things, and we haven't seen him to this point. And then you get something like this, and he's just like he's beef.
Yeah.
So it's going to be interesting to see how they move this character through the storyline, and if he's going to be somebody who's going to be recurring in the next movies, or if this is Jonathan Majors right now has been such a unique pillar in most of the movies that he's been kind of put in for this year, that you don't really know if they're going to look at just pushing him off to the side after that and moving forward, or if they're going to keep him in it in some kind of pivotal role. Mm-hmm. You know, you were going to say something, Amy?
I was going to say, Spencer, how do you feel about your movie that you picked that you're excited for? He just kind of took over.
He talked about it.
Yeah. Huh? And one other thing that I'm excited for in this movie is that it's supposed to be Michael B. Jordan's first directorial.
That's
movie.
True.
So
that's true.
Excited for that. See how well he does.
Oh, that's right.
That'll be interesting. I'm anxious to see how he does in comparison to the first two movies with Ryan Coogler, who did both of the first two movies. So who knows? You know, I'm not saying he's not capable. I'm just saying for a movie series or a movie franchise that has done so well as it has up until this point, it'll be interesting. My last pick for what is to come in 2023 is kind of an interesting one because I just found out about it, to be honest, yesterday, and I've been reading more up about it today, and it's The Exorcist sequel. They're creating a sequel to The Exorcist in October by the same team who brought Halloween back. Back in 2018, really? David Gordon Green, Jason Blum, they're going to bring, what's
Seth
his
Rogen? Name? No.
What?
No. Danny McBride.
Danny McBride.
Sorry, happened like that.
That'd be interesting.
Yeah,
it's
no.
It's produced by Seth Green.
David Gordon Green, who has had a history in cinema for doing very niche and very unique movies, kind of cut his teeth in the horror franchise with the Halloween spiritual sequel, if you will, to the original back in 2018. There's not much to say about his sequels, but his initial jump from that first film to almost, 30, 40 years later, so much time, was not only flawless, but perfection, you know? And so for them to take on a movie like The Exorcist and give us some sense of a sequel to it, there's a lot riding on it. Like, you have not only the impact of the movie that it was on society at the time, but you're also going to be competing against unique performances, you know, in that movie by Linda Blair and, you know, and so many others in that film. And on top of that, the cursed mentalities and controversies that befell that movie as a result of it coming out. I'm anxious to see it, not just because of the fact that it's a sequel to a movie that I'm actually a fan of, and is very, it's a very unique film in the cinematic history of horror, but I'm also anxious to see what it's going to bring to people who have never seen The Exorcist and may actually finally give it the time of day, you know, as an option for like, hey, in spite of everything else going on, this movie is now trending again and you should see it kind of thing. So, but this is a part of a much larger conversation and we will dive deeper into that and release that episode soon. But that does draw us to our main topic of the evening. And that is our thoughts and review of Netflix's Glass Onion, a Knives Out mystery. This movie has essentially been one of the most talked about pertaining to the whodunit world because we've started getting more into whodunit movies with the Hercule Poirot series films.
Poirot.
Hercule. Hercule. The Man with the Mustache. We've had those movies come back into the forefront. We've had movies that have been really building on the whole idea of creating more mystery than fear and you know, thriller kind of thing. And Knives Out, the first one that came out, was such a success that we absolutely had to have a second one, and we finally got it. So before we dive deep more into this, Spencer, why don't you give us that official synopsis goodness?
Five longtime friends are invited to the Greek island home of billionaire Miles Braun. The crew have known Braun way back and owe their current wealth, fame, and careers to him. The main event of the weekend is a murder whodunit game with Braun to be the victim. In reality, they all have reasons to kill him, but a cog is thrown into the social machine when a sixth individual is mysteriously invited to the shindig. Renoir Blanc, the world's greatest detective.
That's right. Written, produced, and directed by Rian Johnson, the film stars Daniel Craig, Edward Norton, Janelle Monáe, Catherine Hahn, Leslie Odom Jr., Jessica Henwick, Madeline Klein, Kate Hudson, and Dave Bautista. A little bit of information. In an interview with The Atlantic, director Rian Johnson actually expressed his frustration over having to add, in quote, a Knives Out mystery, end quote, to the film's title for marketing purposes, as he wanted every film to be self-contained except for Daniel Craig's appearances. He, quote, he stated, honestly, I'm pissed off that we have, quote, a Knives Out mystery, end quote, in the title, you know? I wanted to just be called Glass Onion, he adds. I get it, and I want everyone who liked the first movie to know that to know this is next in the series, but also the whole appeal to me is it's a new novel off the shelf every time, end quote. Which I get. I mean, you know, you're wanting to create something that doesn't have to constantly tie back to the first film because it's not about a series. It's not supposed to be like chronologically like that, but it's just a shared universe. Mm-hmm. You know, it'd be like if every single, you know, Spider-Man movie or Iron Man or whatever was Marvel, like in the title itself, like a Marvel film, like Iron Man, a Marvel film.
Logo in there.
Yes, but it's in the branding. It's not in the name. It's not the name.
Should have done that. Just put a brand. So it's like Knives Out.
There you go.
KO.
I think this is kind of taking a kinship to the fact that the Poirot series from Agatha Christie does not have a Hercule Poirot like mystery inside the title. So if it's Death on the River Nile or Murder on the Orient Express or the ABC murders, they don't have a, unless it's branded on the
but
the
then
books.
Those ones, some of those are Agatha Christie's the ABC murders or whatever, or some of them do have like the writer in there,
yeah,
for some of those mysteries.
Well, and they could put in Rian Johnson's the Glass Onion or Glass Onion, whatever it is. But yeah, but saying it's Knives Out when it's not like those
particular
back,
characters, yeah. Like, we didn't see Ana de Armas reprise her role. We didn't see Jamie Lee Curtis show up in this one. We didn't see Don Johnson. We didn't see any of those other folks. So it's interesting that they kind of forced that in there. But I guess for, like, name recognition or something? Who knows? It's Netflix. Another piece of information. This was the final film of Stephen Sondheim and Dame Angela Lansbury, who appeared briefly in a Zoom video call during Benoit's first scene. Rian Johnson is a fan of Sondheim's film The Last of Sheila from 1973, another whodunit about a multimillionaire who invites his friends to a party to play parlor games. Diane Cannon's character in that film was an influence on Kate Hudson's character Birdie. Amy was the one who had first mentioned it when she saw the movie. She texted me and said, oh my gosh, you have to watch the movie because there's a really cool scene with, Daniel Craig in the bathtub. And I didn't know what she meant.
That was the politest way to say it without ruining it. It's Daniel Craig in the bathtub.
But he's sitting in a bathtub and he's actually playing Among Us with, oddly enough, Stephen Sondheim, Dame Angela Lansbury, the woman from
Natasha Lyonne
and
Kareem
Abdul-Jabbar.
Which they're all in. So the fun thing about that is they're all tied into mysteries. Stephen Sondheim with the movie that you just mentioned. Of course, Angela Lansbury is Murder, She Wrote, which her name is M. She Solved. Yeah. as her, like, her little name. And then Natasha Lyonne is in a movie called Poker Face. Apparently, it's supposed to be another murder mystery. And then Cream was in Fletch, which is another murder mystery as well. I read things on the internet.
We can see that. it's unfortunate that Stephen Sondheim and Dame Angela Lansbury passed, and having the opportunity to see them one more time in a very fun and very unique yet casual setting seemed really great, especially since the entire film kind of takes place during the COVID pandemic. So the whole idea of being on a Zoom call made a lot of sense. But it was still great to see them in the film, and it was a great surprise for a lot of folks. Moving forward, one last piece of information. When Netflix actually bought the rights for the film, a third movie also began development, again with director Rian Johnson and actor Daniel Craig returning, which means they're going to keep the whole thing with Daniel Craig, Benoit Blanc. But the bigger kind of interesting thing is they're keeping Rian Johnson on for another one, which is interesting because he's bringing a lot of, like we had just mentioned, he's bringing a lot of like almost not quite negative press, but grievances towards Netflix's direction toward like their marketing or whatever.
I mean, to be fair, some of it was kind of annoying.
What?
Like them having, it's in the theater for a week.
Yeah.
The week of Thanksgiving. Like, what the heck is that?
True. Very true. But that does mean that we will get another chance to see Benoit Blanc and how that film shakes up. I don't know if it'll be essentially made to be a trilogy or just a stream of films. Who knows? But talking about this movie, Glass Onion, A Knives Out Mystery, we'll just call it Glass Onion. Glass Onion or Knives Out 2, has been this movie that everybody has been anticipating. And if you saw the first film, you would understand that whole magic behind the way that Daniel Craig's character really does break down certain mysteries and murders and everything else in between, the whole donut hole with a hole in it kind of thing. It was really a sweet film and a fun film to watch with a really interesting cast of characters. Who would have thought Don Johnson could have got Jamie Lee Curtis? But just saying. So this movie was one that a lot of people had been looking forward to. And despite the fact that it went to a streaming service, which I don't know about you guys, but I was pretty concerned when it was mentioned that it was going to Netflix, rather than just being released into theaters. I don't know the reasoning behind it, but how did you guys feel when you heard?
Oh, I just assumed Netflix finally bought something like decent. Like, I was assuming that, like, they're like, we want prestige. And so they're like, yes, Knives Out. That's something that's probably cheap enough for us to buy at this point. And so they just got it. I didn't actually think of it as a mark on the film's quality, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
What about you, Ames?
I am a bit in the middle. I like being able to wear my pajamas and be at home to watch a...
I mean, you could do that at the movie theater, but you'd be looked...
I'd be looked at fairly awkwardly. I appreciate that enthusiasm about properly dressing for a movie. But being able to watch it at home, I do appreciate that. The thing was that I was hesitant because, one, they only had a week long in the theater, which I knew drove down ticket prices or revenue, box office revenue. But then also the fact that I don't know. It just yay and not yay simultaneously, I guess, at it being on a streaming service.
Well, I think now that I'm hearing you guys out and I'm thinking about it, ever since the Academy Board began to kind of change up the way they viewed how they awarded films and they defined the word film as far as entry. When they started including streaming films, because that's the whole reason why Roma from a few years back won so many awards from Netflix, even though so many directors were against it because they were like, oh, you know, if it's in streaming, it should be an Emmy. It should win an Emmy, not an Academy Award. But I think the fact is that seeing as if a movie can be seen more times than most, and be given more opportunities to have like people vote on it as a good movie, because think about, I guess, exposure. And if you have a movie that's being, like, people are able to see it 100 times in a given month, as opposed to having to pay to maybe see it 5-6 times, it makes more sense to have it exposed to more people, so that those that are maybe on the board, those who have ability to lean in on certain situations like that, individuals like for the BAFTAs and things like that, who are, those awards are determined by press, members of the press. Mm-hmm. I can tell you, as being a member of the press, if there's an opportunity for me to see a really great movie maybe 5-10 times, rather than having to pay and only see it maybe 3-4 times, I'm going to remember more the movie that I got a chance to see, you know, a lot more times. And come award season, when it comes to voting, I'd be like, you know what? I really like this movie. I saw it like 3 times that one weekend on Netflix, or I saw this movie 12 times in a given weekend off of Hulu. I was just binging the heck out of it. It makes a little bit more sense. I don't know how they do it in terms of revenue, because I guess box office numbers are no longer a thing. Who knows? I'm just... But you're looking at me weird, Amy, because I'm just like...
I think it needs to be an extra credit episode, because this brings up questions for me about movie houses, and is this going to drive them to be a thing of the past?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And that's something that I would like to delve into at a later date, because we're talking about Glass Onions right now.
Well, no, because that's actually a really great point, though. Like, the idea... And we've talked about this on the show, Spencer, before. Mm-hmm. We've talked about how... The implications of what streaming platforms are doing to actual, you know, theater houses and movie theaters, and why it's now kind of a popularity game, where certain directors, certain individuals in places of power within the industry, who are fighting to keep the allure and nostalgia and the draw in for the main theater houses, are strongly against, you know, streaming platforms, putting movies out on streaming platforms directly before they even hit the theaters. Mm-hmm. But it is a conversation to be had, yes, at another time, because there's a lot to kind of really deep dive into. But it is, mm-hmm. honestly, I feel, one of the biggest, I almost want to say it's like one of the biggest business wars type episodes that's to come. because this is one of those things where one is going to trump over the other, or because there will never be a peace amongst them. Mm-hmm. As long as you have companies, big giants like Disney, or, you know, or Netflix, or, you know, even, well, Hulu is owned by Disney too. Mm-hmm. Like, you have or HBO Max, these big entities who have the power and the draw ability to bring in like original movies by great directors, there will always be that fight. So
I'm just going to add a little streaming wars thing to our list of things.
Yay! You just got a glimpse of a future 2023 episode. But talking about this movie, so let's talk about expectations, because we've seen the first one, and to be completely frank, it was a in theaters movie. And the first one really, really took a lot of people by surprise. I mean, I'm going to be completely honest. I didn't really think I was going to like Daniel Craig with a Southern accent. Mm. Lo and behold.
Because it sounds ridiculous.
It does sound ridiculous. Yes. But it is the most wholesome ridiculousness that you can actually enjoy without being stereotypical. So when this next one came out and I saw the trailer, there were some questions. And I want to see what your guys' thoughts were in walking into the film, and, you know, your expectations. Let's start with Amy.
So expectations, seeing the trailer, my brain initially goes, oh, we're following up our Murder on the Orient Express with a Death on the River Nile style type of.
Because you thought it was going to be on a boat?
Yeah, because that was initially the teasers. All we saw was them on the gangplank to the boat. I didn't really try to delve aggressively into any of the marketing or reading into it as a lot, because the fun of a murder mystery is not knowing where it's going or even kind of what the premise or the setup is, which meant that my expectations were it's a murder mystery and it's a murder mystery. So, yeah.
So you had nothing. Got it.
I came in with next to nothing, therefore I could enjoy it at its purest level.
Spencer, what about you in terms of expectations?
I came in with next to nothing because yes. I was like, I wouldn't have wanted like Knives Out spoiled for me at all. So I was like, okay, trailer, and now I'm not going to look up absolutely anything until I'm like watching it.
I mean, so the thing is, yes, I stayed away from any kind of spoiler, any kind of delve into the story, but a lot of what my expectations were based upon number one, what I got out of the first film. Mm-hmm. Number two, who I'm going to see in the second film. Mm-hmm. And the equation out of one and two, which is three, how I can get that, if I'm able to get that same performance from the first film out of these characters. Mm-hmm. So it was a matter of kind of quantifying how can I make sure that whatever quality of film that I got out of that first movie, I'm going to make sure I get out of this one. And I'm not going to lie, I was a little concerned. I'm not the biggest Kate Hudson fan. I love Dave Bautista, but there are certain limitations that people can, you know, are capable of. I mean, Dave Bautista is really making a name for himself for a lot of other things, not to mention he's already stated this last Guardians of the Galaxy movie is going to be his last one because he doesn't actually want Drax to be his legacy, mm-hmm. which is understandable. Mm-hmm. You know, he wants to and mind you, he's done other great things. He was in Blade Runner 2049. He was in Spectre.
Yeah, he was in James Bond.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. He was Inspector.
Oh, sorry. The way that you said not it was like a question. Not, and I was like, yes?
Not Inspector in the movie Spectre.
Yes.
And he's done so many unique roles, and he's continuing. I mean, he's got another movie that's coming out, a horror film. It's called The Knock at the Door.
The Knock at the Door of the Cabin.
Which looks really trippy. Really trippy. Like the most pushiest Jehovah Witnesses you've ever met. But it just looks really scary because it's mostly him. And you know. But I was concerned about this movie. I don't know how well I could take him seriously in this movie if he was supposed to be taken seriously or if he was supposed to be the joke. And if he's supposed to be the joke, then that's just another Drax move. Yeah. And I know he doesn't... That's not what people want to be known for. Edward Norton, we hadn't seen him in a lot as of late, maybe onesie, twosie here and there. It was a very interesting array of characters. I was really hoping we were going to get Leslie Odom Jr. singing something. And we, you know, that was one of my biggest things. He sings. No. Do you not know who Leslie Odom Jr. is? You're
Did
looking
you at... just ask me if I know who Leslie Odom Jr. is?
Okay, let's so, not fight on the podcast. So,
Leslie Odom Jr. is a, just, I'm just kidding. Take it. You know what? Death. Just. No.
Come back.
We're back.
Are you kidding me?
We were able to wrangle intern Amy back to the table, and then she realized that when she left, we decided to eat her peanut butter.
You!
No, I did. I was
Spencer
not.
Spencer is absolved of any of your actions.
I was not told. I ate some, yes, but I was not told.
Thank you. See?
Oh, see? No, yeah. You're still absolved of this.
So back to the conversation.
First off, you didn't even know who Leslie Odom Jr. was until he showed up in Hamilton. Thank you very much. I knew about him when he was in Smash.
As she pushes up her glasses.
Yeah, let me do it correctly.
Madam Gatekeeper here. Hold on. So I saw him. See, go ahead.
Because you literally...
Because it's a pudding pops.
No.
No, we don't do that anymore. We can't do that.
No. No.
So, back to the...
All you're thinking about is pudding pops now.
So, expectations. We haven't even passed expectations. So much time has passed. I don't know. I had a concern for what I was going to get in terms of quality of the movie with the characters we had. Obviously, Catherine Hahn has made a name for herself with Agatha Harkness in WandaVision. And Leslie Odom Jr. is Leslie Odom Jr. But the likes of like Edward Norton, whom has had a history of being difficult with studios and so forth, which is why he's no longer the Hulk. And Kate Hudson, who I don't really put a lot of weight in complex performances, which is, you know, we'll talk about it. Yeah, I was concerned overall. So, but let's talk about first impressions. So as soon as the movie finished, what were your guys' first impressions? Spencer, I'm going to let you go first, because every time I let Amy go first, Amy does the whole opens her eyes wide and then expects the audience to hear her her pupils dilate as she gives us a one-word expression. So I'll let you go first.
Never before have I seen a movie so succinctly summed up within the first 5 minutes of the movie. So I was actually like, yeah, like the way this movie ends, like the beginning of the movie just like kind of tells you. And I'm like, interesting. Interesting way to go.
Yep. Amy.
Did we put a spoiler warning on the beginning of this?
Spoiler alert.
Is that a spoiler? You have to watch the movie to know it's a spoiler.
Within the first 5 minutes, if you're...
Okay, okay. Ladies and gentlemen, just so you know, this is your spoiler alert warning, blah, 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 blah. You know how we do. Amy, go.
Yay. First impression was, well, that was actually pretty good. I kind of like this. Not as much as like the first one, but I like this.
There you go. My first impression right outside the gate, I thought it was fun. I thought it was very different from the first film. It had almost the same quality, but it was still a great movie. There were certain parts of it that I felt... if we're doing apples to apples, it's almost like there was just much more of like a caliber of performance in that first film. Everybody from Christopher Plummer to Jamie Lee Curtis to Michael Shannon, like, oh my gosh. Yeah, we had, you know, Captain America himself, Chris Evans in it. You know, it was just, it was a different movie. Mm-hmm. This one, there wasn't that many characters that I felt I really kind of connected with. But overall, the movie gave me something really good. So I enjoyed it, but let's kind of dive deep as we step into the review here, of the story itself. The story itself is kind of interesting because it doesn't necessarily continue like most other sequels directly after the end of the last one. Obviously, some time has been passed. We have Benoit Blanc, who's kind of in a little bit of a sleuthing stump. Where he feels like there's really no challenge out there. And then all the events happen in this film. One of the things that is definitively different about this movie compared to the first film is there's not a lot of detective work really in it. I mean, to be completely frank, a lot of it is more of what the audience is seeing, as opposed to what's knowledge to Benoit Blanc. We take it for granted that Benoit Blanc is the most, is the world's greatest detective. And in the first film, there was several opportunities where he showed that. You know, even in that one scene where at the very end where Ana de Armas' character is like, you know, how did you know that I knew he had, you know, he died? And he goes, yeah, you know, the blood stain on her shoe, which was so minute and small, but the fact that this character made it known. We get a glimpse of it throughout beginning of the second act when they do the murder mystery thing. But there's not a lot of problem solving. There's not a lot of like sleuthing happening in the movie. I don't know. Did you guys feel that way as well? Or I just felt like there wasn't as much detective work happening.
Yeah, because like I feel like anytime it comes down to like detective-ish type things happening in the movie, it's done by Janelle Monáe's character versus his.
Yeah.
Well, she is out there working this case.
Yeah.
While she brings all the pieces and he like, oh, well, this is how it all fits together.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's a lot less of that because, like, when you're not with her, you're just with Blanc as he's waiting for her to find something out.
Amy, what do you think?
Well, and this is where I kind of also akined it a bit to Death on the River Nile. There's a similar character who's almost a little bit Watson-esque to Hercule Poirot's character in that, who kind of...
Yeah, it's not easy to say, is it?
Poirot? See?
Whatever.
Who has been kind of collecting... He's almost like the... he plays more of a detective than the actual detective.
Why don't you just name the character? Who is the character? Because I'm trying to recollect.
He's in the new one. He was Russell Brand's character, who was a doctor. Like, left field, he was a doctor. But it's very much kind of like, they're doing the work, and then it's like, ah, yes. So it must be this. Like, I can agree that it didn't feel that we were seeing Daniel Craig's Blanc having more detective epiphany moments. Mm-hmm. And we were living it kind of in the space of the jumbled recollection that we were getting from Janelle Monáe's character.
Yeah.
Which is interesting and a way to pivot the mystery to be focused and not focus simultaneously on our detective.
Yeah, because in the first film, we get all those really interesting moments with Ana de Armas' character and Lakeith Stanfield and Benoit Blanc, you know, Daniel Craig, and the other officers as they look for clues, as they're checking tapes, as they're looking at, you know, what are those called, like trestles or...
Trellis.
The things that run up the wall for the...
The trellis.
Looking at the trellis or... like investigating, like in interviewing, things like that. There was a lot more of that in that first movie, and it felt almost very clueish. Like, you know, there was a lot more of, you don't know what's going to happen, you don't know what's happening here, and we're going to take it bit by bit. And it was like every single part of the movie was bit by bit. You were engrossed in it because you didn't know where it was going to lead.
I wonder if that's because these two movies are dealing with a murder mystery from different perspectives. Because the first one, like, someone died and you're dealing with it. Well, mm-hmm. this one, someone might die, like, mm-hmm. specifically, and we're trying to, like, reverse engineer who's going to do it before it happens.
That's a good point.
Very nice.
Because the actual murder that occurs in this movie happens in the third act, mm-hmm. like, at the beginning of the third act, but that third act runs wild. No, I take that back. It's midway through the movie. Because after the events of that happens, and then you have the big moment with Janelle Monáe's character out in the courtyard, it then flashes back to the beginning of the movie mm-hmm. from a different perspective. And you get more information, you have more understanding, and it kind of rebuilds back to that point. Which, case in point, I'm not a big fan of that. I don't like having to re-go back through the story for another perspective, which is essentially telling me the same story twice mm-hmm. with minor details added in. And I'm not saying he's not a great director or writer. I'm not saying this is all, at all. What I am saying is a seasoned director will find ways to pepper in those moments throughout the film so you don't have to do that.
I also felt like it kind of killed like the film's like
momentum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, because like at that point, something really like exciting had happened. And then it's like, okay, and now back to the beginning.
Yeah.
And it's like, let's go. Yeah. We were doing so well.
Yeah. Because you're at this point where a big moment happens in the film and everybody's in shock. And then it rewinds. It takes out all the impact of that moment. And it goes back to the beginning, and you have to wait for that whole entire story to be relayed out before you get to that moment to have any kind of resolution just for that moment. There have been times where it has worked out in certain films. I can't think of any at this time, but I'm just not a big fan of, you know,
Monte Cristo.
But
it's also, again, in that juxtaposition. It's very briefly, it's right sandwiched between the second and third act, and it's not enough where it is the entire story, and it gives you tidbits. So it's like, this moment you want to kind of know what was happening. And this moment you kind of want to know what was happening.
Well, so a couple key opportunities that in film where it shows things like that, like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Very true.
But it's not the whole movie. It's not a whole,
It's portion not the storyline from another perspective.
It's bits and pieces that are peppered throughout.
It's not Midnight Sun in the Twilight Saga.
God, no.
Exactly the reason I brought it up. And I've never read that book.
The Godfather Part 2, where it tells the story of Don Corleone as both now or his son, and then his father's legacy, how he came to come to power. Which it's done really well with Robert De Niro, Al Pacino. you know, there's a lot of other ones like Kill Bill Volume 1.
But again, those are small moments which are leading.
Exactly.
And it's not the full layout, because if we're following the bride, like, you're like, why is she in this situation? And you flash to what happened, and then you're like, okay, it makes sense. Versus we were getting abundant moments of dialogue. Like, if we had gotten that initial moment with the meeting for Blanc and Janelle Monáe's character, and we had that and we left it there, I think that would have given us just enough of the sprinkling that we needed to be like, okay, something's maybe might be right, might not be right.
Well, because like the idea of a flashback is twofold. Like, there's two main opportunities to use it. You either use flashbacks in sparing doses throughout the entire movie that fit in certain parts of the film to help add context or substance to certain scenes that you'll be expecting coming up, or the entire plot, if you will, is based on the flashback. Take, for instance, movies like, what is that movie? Saving Private Ryan. The entire movie is a flashback. Movies like Forrest Gump. Forrest Gump is, the whole movie is a flashback for him. He's recounting his past. The Green Mile. There's a lot of those movies that utilize that reminiscent mindset without overtaking the idea of we're gonna have portion of the story here and then like portion of the story right here, and it's on even footing, but it's the whole story retold in both accounts. Which honestly is a little frustrating as a fan of movies, because like I want to see the movie in how it can be perfectly served to the audience without having to add more repetition, if you will.
Do you think if the flashback had been spread out more, then it would have done a better job at giving you the tidbits as well as not sucking the momentum out of the movie,
Spencer? I think it would have.
Yeah.
Because I feel like that one, like it, doing it earlier on and then in a shorter time frame, it gets you set up for like, oh, there might be more in the future. And then like you can still keep that level of momentum and avoid like putting in like what felt like a 10 to 15-ish minute chunk of the movie where it's like, let's go back and explain the first half of this movie.
Like a great opportunity that does a great movie that takes that opportunity and does it well is The Usual Suspects. You know, you have Verbal Hint, who is essentially recounting this story to a detective, and it's going back and forth because you have things that are happening in the current situation with, you know, people still being pulled from wreckages, finding survivors, getting, you know, some what are those called, that draw a sketch artist to draw the person that is the actual, you know, Kaiser Sose, and all the while it's all happening at the same time, but the story is also happening and unfolding before the detective. And that's done well, where you don't know that the main character is who he is saying he's not in the film until the very, very end. And it's just, it's such a mind-blowing moment for those who haven't already had it ruined. But it's done well enough. I feel like they could have done more in this film to create instances that, kind of like Spencer said, give it piecemeal at a time, give us hints of things, give us certain instances, or even out of context situations, like out of context scenes where like, oh, someone's sneaking in and seeing this, but at the very back you see this person who comes out, their little silhouette comes out, and it looks like, oh, is that so-and-so's character? I don't know. And then as the film builds, you come to find out it was, because the reveal kind of thing.
Well, and I think that might also be the setup and design of the story, because when we look at the first, in juxtaposition, when we look at the first film, and I know they're supposed to be both self-contained, but I'm taking them as two completely separate pieces. There are moments where we see flashbacks because we're having those interview sequences, much like you would with like, and I will continue to bring it up, Murder on the Orient Express. When you're having those inner detective interview moments, you get the slice of the perspective from those people at that time. And then it picks up and moves to a different location. The problem that I feel that Glass Onion has is that essentially it is a party game where you cannot take everybody aside and have those one-on-one moments. You have to do your party trick in the middle of the, like, essentially in the middle of the table, and everybody can see you work. And it reminded me of, like, because there's no police presence. They're not going to call the police until much later, or whenever this is happening in Act 3, when we have our, you know, the murder mystery party goes off. And you essentially have left Blanc in the middle of the party, and he's got to do his parlor trick and point out who the person actually is without being able to take the time to do the detective work. And I don't know if that was a disservice to him, or it's kind of like being in the pandemic for so long and suddenly getting dropped into the middle of a party. And they're like, do your trick that you were known for so many years ago. Do it right now. Do it in front of all of us. And everyone's like, yeah, do your party trick. And you're like, yes, I can do that.
Well, and I feel like in this particular movie, number one, I feel like you're right. It actually does do a disservice to Daniel Craig's character. But at the same time, gives much more importance on the role that Janelle Monáe carries as the character that she is in the film. And the problem is it's without qualification, I guess. Like, there's intent and motivation behind it, but qualification outside of just getting all the clues together. And then I feel like she did a great job. But I feel like I would have wished that Benoit Blanc had done some of that as well, instead of kind of being the person who the retriever brings back the treasures and whatnot, and he puts it together to have the glory.
But did he really do that? Because when you go to a murder mystery party, is the goal that the person who is the police officer in his real life is going to win the party and find the killer, or is it supposed to be somebody else's? Like,
it's supposed to be the police officer.
It's supposed to. So if we take we take him to a murder mystery party, Spencer, let it be known that he has to win because he is so good with logic and nobody else is allowed to win.
I don't think that's the argument that's being made. It's more along the lines of when somebody who within the first act of the film is being touted as not being challenged enough, or not finding another challenge that is, you know, to meet the requirements of himself. And then he's put on an island to figure out a true murder plot. And doesn't really do a lot of the legwork in it. It just kind of sours a little bit of, was he really missing it, or did he just want to get out of the house? Like, and that's kind of where in lies.
I mean, in the pandemic, we all went.
Exactly.
And he does keep bringing up that he's rusty. Like, that in, like, the first act, that all these people were invited to the island except for him, and he's like, I received a mysterious an anonymous invitation, which is a callback to the first movie, but that it's just odd. And he keeps bringing up that he's rusty, and like, he couldn't figure out Among Us either, and that Dame Angela Lansbury brings it up, and she's like, we saw you do it. We know you're the murderer. And he's like, what? No, you didn't see me. And I think that might be more of the way we're supposed to kind of read into this is a changing an environment for a detective that cannot do the traditional detective work and has to rely on somebody else or a partner to get the job done.
So do you think then that this movie was not meant to continue the legacy of what was created out of the first film, but to help the audience recognize that Benoit Blanc is a man of his time, that essentially, despite his illustrious awareness skills, is still behind the times and is a flawed detective. What do you think, Spence? Because I'm trying to hear what you're saying, Amy, and I am hearing it. I'm not just trying. I'm hearing what you're saying. I also know where I stand in terms of like what I saw in the film with him, but to the greater good, I guess, if you will, of the filmmaker, like what was the purpose? Like there had to be a purpose behind it. He didn't just intentionally write Benoit Blanc to be this, you know, oafish character who just shows up at times to get the information and then his deducing ability puts it together without putting in the work to see and find and, you know, uncover and unravel and reveal.
Well, so I don't know. I did have like a hard time like putting that part together. It's like, you know, I couldn't tell if it was like a weird way of trying to like give the character like a weakness, mm-hmm. if you will, just to make sure that he's not like this crime solving god.
Yeah,
who's, like,
yeah.
He walks into a room and it was this person. Like, so like it's a great question. I'm not sure what the real answer is though.
Yeah, I think it was a bit, and to say this is a part of the plot device. Oh my gosh, I'm gonna Catherine
Hahn.
Yes, her when she realizes that it's Benoit Blanc on the pier, and she's like, "Oh, weren't you the one that did?" And she starts listing off these crimes that he solved. It's already kind of perpetuated that idea that he is the crime solving god. Like, he always gets his man, which is very akin to Hercule Poirot. And then the fact that he is struggling to find a killer in a game where the chaos, like online, it was the chaos of you're around a whole bunch of different people simultaneously. How do you function as a killer, or how do you function as a detective when there are so many moving parts that you can't stop and question somebody, or you can't see everybody, and it's happening real time? So I don't know if the setup was entirely to say that he is a man of his time, but that the concept of murder in a social setting in society where it is essentially a team is changing and something that he hasn't dealt with before. He doesn't know how to adapt, and mm-hmm. and he's working towards adapting and understanding, but it's not coming as easily as him being able to point out the murder mystery within and the answer to the murder within 5 minutes of sitting down at a dinner table.
Yeah, see, that was also another thing. I was like, you say you're rusty, but you figure that. Yep. Like, I know what probably was not hard, but like he's just like zipped right through that.
Yeah, and that's also one of the kind of indicators for me that confused me a bit in terms of his quote unquote rustiness or his ability to sleuth, because there was something that was talked about what was in his bathroom when he was in the tub. There's a book in there called Cain's Jawbone. Cain's Jawbone is a murder mystery novel that was written way back when, but it's essentially a book that the pages are not in order. And it's essentially a large puzzle within a book. And to this day, only 4 people have solved it. But it's in his bathroom. It's on the floor in his bathroom, which would lead me to believe that maybe he's the 5th person who solved it. However, that also adds to the inquiry of if he was able to solve that, then where it just doesn't kind of strike on par with why he didn't do a lot of the sleuthing or a lot of the things on his end, or who knows? Like, because ultimately the way the movie ends, he doesn't even figure out how to resolve the case. In fact, the case is resolved in someone else's hands, so to speak. He wipes his hands clean of it and then walks out, mm-hmm. which is almost...
he doesn't wipe his hands clean of it. He understands where his ability to bring about justice is, what he is capable of, and what he cannot do to bring about justice, that it cannot be him to essentially to get the resolution that's sought.
But I mean, if and this goes back to a man out of, you know, man of his own time kind of mindset, because then this leads to the mindset of there are ways to go around it. There are ways to find the, I mean, with technology and the modern day way of investigation, there was probably ways to find, you know, the clues that they were needing. Unfortunately, he is not, as it's shown with his inability to play Among Us. There are ways out of his depth to finding how to bring the killer to justice. I don't know. It's interesting. The manner as to how they presented him in this film. I'm not saying it's entirely bad. Mm-hmm. It is a different way. And I did mention that at the beginning of the movie. It is a different way to go about a murder mystery film. Very much kind of like the Orient Express type way of how to solve something, if you've seen Murder on the Orient Express. But yeah, I'm hoping that there's more intentionality behind a lot of what was seen in the film. And I'm pretty sure many people who have the time to, like, frame by frame and investigate every single instance in the film will probably find it out. Like, they'll probably, you know, come out with it, like, oh, well, this means X, Y, and Z, or this means that. Like some people are saying Kane's jawbone, which obviously, like I said, is out of order and relies on, like, going back through other pages to find clues and so forth, is essentially a nod towards the film using flashback as a means to completing the story. So there's that. But there's, I'm pretty sure, a lot of other things in the film that would probably give more credence to what we saw in the film. Ames, was there anything else you wanted to add?
No, I think that was it for the moment. I haven't really done a lot of... I went Easter egg looking for my research, so I didn't actually go take the time to kind of look at reviews, except I know that
Let's talk about that. What were some of your... What were some... Some... Because I don't know if Spencer may have some. Oh, no. What were some of your favorite Easter eggs that you found? Hold on. Let's leave it at three. Let's limit it to three.
I have zero Easter eggs.
It's okay. We're going to play like you have more and keep Amy to her.
You're like, quickly, to the Google machine. I liked the what initially looks like a wishbone on Leslie Odom Jr.'s lapel, as well as on the yacht, is actually the Omega sign. And the name of the Facebook-esque entity that Miles owns is Alpha. So it kind of harkens that it's the end of him. I also liked...
Oh, you mean his like, yeah, YouTube channel and social empire kind of thing?
That's Duke. But it's for... Alpha was the name of, like, Miles... is like his big company is called Alpha.
Oh, that's right. It's the company name. Yeah. You're right, right.
Then all the really, and it sounds really dumb, but all the name dropping cameos was really ridiculous. So I did appreciate that. The Blackbird on the guitar, when they show up and he's playing Blackbird on the guitar, that was it McCartney that wrote it?
Blackbird?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was McCartney.
Yeah, on the guitar, and then he just drops it, and I was just like, oh, my soul, please don't be the real thing. And then I had one more, and my brain is just kind of fried trying to remember it. I swear I will. If I ever find it.
Spencer.
My brain just goes,
Was there anything that you enjoyed, or outside of, because you said you didn't have any Easter eggs, mm-hmm, were there any highlight moments of the film that you really liked?
I mean, honestly, I kind of liked the cast. I thought, like, they were an interesting bunch, not as good as, like, the last group of people we got, but, like, they were entertaining to watch through this movie, as, like, they were, like, kind of, like, in, like, a lot of scenes, like, just had their personalities on displays, like, how most of the friends were really into like Miles Puzzle Box, but like Manel Jonet's character like just like hacked through it just to get right through it because she was not gonna play any of his games. And I really just appreciated, like, you know, the intelligence of her character and how Detective Blanc is just able to like basically put it all together that everyone's an idiot and not really as smart as they seem.
Yeah. I feel like the one thing that I so a couple of the little Easter eggs that I liked, I like the fact that we got a vocal cameo from Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
He's the dong.
He's the dong, as in the individual who calls out the hour every time with a loud...
He's the hourly dong.
He's the hourly dong.
Didn't you say that was developed by Philip Glass, too?
Yes.
I was like, what?
Which I have no idea.
I don't even know what that means.
Yeah, neither do I. But like the fact that that's his second cameo in a Knives Out film, because he was... He did the vocal performance of the Law and Order spoof film or show that Ana de Armas' character or sister was watching while the news reporters were outside. It's funny. It's like, okay, you know, you're brought on just to play the dong.
Sorry. I know they were saying gong, but then it just turned into the hourly dong. So,
which isn't that what he's named at in the credits?
Yeah.
The hourly dong or something. I also like the fact that in the movie, like, you get a lot of really great foreshadowing throughout the entire movie. But one of the biggest ones that I really, really liked was the fact that the design, the way the design of each of the puzzles was and how every time there was a new puzzle that presented, it was Dave Bautista's Duke, his mom, figured it out before everyone else.
Well, and then there was Yo-Yo Ma.
Oh, and then you had Yo-Yo Ma who showed up.
Yo-Yo Ma's like, well, let Kate me Hudson's just tell birdie. You about that. That's what this is. And you're just like, oh, Yo-Yo Ma. Sorry, it got really loud.
You did.
Sorry.
But I think one of the biggest things that I liked about it all was how obvious there were instances throughout the whole movie and the kind of, not so much foreshadowing, but more of like heralding what each step was going to happen next, which played into, and I'm not saying that as a deficit of the film, I'm saying that it plays into the ultimate realization of the character of one of the individuals as a fraud, as someone who is not original, somebody who plagiarizes from everyone, who takes everyone else's idea, who gets rich off of taking from others, which you come to find how the situations happen in the movie. Were there any issues that you guys had?
So,
oh boy,
near the end of the movie,
oh boy,
Janelle Monáe's character has found a rather critical piece of evidence.
Yes.
And then while she has this evidence, she basically shoves it in the bad person's face and it's like, I've got you and this is what's going on around here, and then they burn it and I'm like, why would you even let this in this person's vicinity?
It's flammable.
Like, that just like floored me. I'm like, what is happening? Like, I would have done that from 20 feet away. It's like, I can't the thing. And like, just had...
Or
like,
not even. I would have just ran off the island and be like, okay, I need to get out of it. It's like when you find the treasure in a massive treasure hunt, you don't go up to the competition and say, no. Like, you go and you run back to where you need to report, I got the treasure, or cash it out. Like, it just seemed like a, yeah, interesting move.
Very weird. That was it for me.
Amy?
Well, that one's a good one. I do agree with that. I also, for a quick back to a thing that I liked the resolution in this, what ended up happening, and the way that it took the resolution was really nice. Issues that I had, which I think it's more of, it was just ridiculous, and so it made me laugh, and it was ridiculous, but that the... when we have the dock that comes up out of the water can only be perceived at low tide. It can only come up at low tide. And there's the old Greek man that's just yelling that it is expletive, expletive. And they're like, I don't understand what you're saying. And then he's basically saying it's poop.
It's a poop deck.
It's literally a poop pier. That was frustrating. There were instances where things were frustrating to me from, and this is going to sound weird, from a logical sense. Mm-hmm. Like, just for things where you're like,
right, that does sound weird.
Yeah, it does sound weird for me, right? You. For me, the mm-hmm. whimsical daydreamer. Woo! Mm-hmm. Where it's just like, no, I, why would you, no, don't do, okay.
And see, like, specifically about that pier.
Yes.
Like, I wildly assumed, oh, it must like adjust for the tide automatically.
Or it floats.
Yeah, or something.
Like it's supposed to float.
Like, so when they said that, I was like, wait, what? It's like, I was floored by that for a second.
Oh my gosh, that. But, something to appreciate on the opposite hand was the way that shots were set up, where they were tiered. I had the opportunity to watch, I think it was with Variety. Yeah, did you get to see the one where it was like break down the shot or break down the scene? He talked about the choreography, the cinematography, the blocking for just one of these scenes, which was the we meet all the characters, kind of their introduction sequence. And the way he was talking about how he built the not only the shot so your eye would be focused on a character, but also how they would be stacked forever in a shot. Yeah. I really liked that, which was wonderful. And then looking hindsight, be able to see that and go, oh, yeah, that was happening. That yeah. was kind of cool.
Because it is interesting because there's part of that where Rian Johnson said that there are certain things that he put into the scene to create lines that direct you to where your eyesight should be. And the focal points of those scenes and how it transitions well between like that character and someone else. And they're still within that eye frame where your eye is already set up. So you're not too busy looking for other things. You're focused on exactly where the scene is kind of built to draw you in.
Oh, and one thing I did have, and this will be my last thing that I did have an issue with, where the large climax and the large, abrupt explosion, mm-hmm. nobody died. I'm salty. Character deaths with that type of equipment should have seen a timely / untimely demise. Kaboom.
I would say my biggest hiccup outside of things that I've already said, there was no singing from Leslie Odom Jr. I'm just saying there was a clear indicator that you could have used that for something. I mean, a Dear Theodosia or something. And
you weren't going to get a Dear Theodosia.
No, not in this
there
movie.
There wasn't even a piano, you know, at what? This man's house.
I don't care. I just was saying.
You would have been happy if he was humming on the pier. If he was just humming quietly to himself.
Yep. Yep.
That actually could have been feasible, though.
Exactly. Yeah.
Especially since this was pandemic and then Disney Plus put on Hamilton.
Yes, they did.
But yeah, I mean, overall, this movie is still one of the things I want to kind of make sure I translate is this is still a good movie. And it's definitely a really good whodunit. We don't honestly have enough of those nowadays. We have a lot more of like whether if it's in the field true of crime. Horror or true crime or some kind of, you know, murderous mayhem, try to survive till the end kind of thing and figure out who the killer is. A lot of the whodunits are masked in a horror-esque type vibe or some kind of extreme crime thriller. To have just simply a whodunit mystery movie that lets you sit there and enjoy watching the deducing and the, you know, the sleuthing and the ability to, you know, just come to the conclusions that you can as a viewer. I mean, I know I was watching it, pausing it and thinking and like, okay, maybe it's so-and-so, maybe it's this, and then rewatching and pausing and, you know, because it's one of those types of movies, you know, and I want people to make sure they understand this movie was not a bad movie. Mm. It was a good, really good thriller, a really good whodunit. And so let's, with that said, Let's go ahead and wrap up this episode, and let's go ahead and give our thoughts whether the film passes or fails, and how many monocles. I want to go ahead and start with Amy.
Of course you do.
Yep.
Also, by the way, before I start this, I wanted to point out that I think this whodunit kind of falls into the cozy murder mystery genre. And that we have not had a lot of.
I'm sorry, what does cozy murder mystery mean?
We watched Murder, She Wrote quite a bit, and we never were afraid that the killer was coming to get us.
Oh, okay, I see.
So your whodunit is still a delight. Thank you, Dame Angela Lansbury. So, of course, this movie does pass for me. It is not my absolute favorite in the run-up of the newer whodunits or the remakes, but this is a delightful entry from Rian Johnson as he continues to explore the ever-changing world of Benoit Blanc. The cast is star-studded. That is not a question. Mm-hmm. And it is still a fun movie on a private island in Greece with Edward Norton.
Which was filmed on an actual set. That glass onion is real. You can, they actually have it for sale currently right now.
On Zillow.
Yeah. So
nobody wants that floating dock.
So if anybody wants to send us the money, we'll buy it and then start recording out of there if you want.
That'd be crazy. but yeah, so I'm going to give this one a 3.5 out of 5 monocles.
Okay.
You ain't no Agatha Christie, but I see the heart. Let's go.
Spencer.
Yeah, this film passes for me. Honestly, I did like the first one a lot better, but I don't feel like this is a bad movie at all, and I'm still kind of interested in seeing the next one, so yeah. I feel like that's still a pretty good job. You didn't throw me off the entire franchise, unlike some other people.
True.
So yeah, for me, I'm going to give this a 3.5 out of 5.
There you go. In terms of me, I am going to say this film passes. It does have a little bit of a rocky narrative midway through the film, and to Spencer's credit, it did throw me off the momentum a little bit, but overall, the film did give me a full and resolute story that I felt really did live up to what we had been building towards in this film. In terms of monocles, now, much like what Amy and Spencer have both been saying, I absolutely adore the first one. I mean, Christopher Plummer, how can you go wrong with that entire cast and crew? That movie was just money. Now, to say that this movie needs to be compared to that one, maybe not so fair. However, the legacy is we hold the entire franchise as a whole in terms of its ability to translate what it wants to translate. And overall, I think this is a good close second, but it's not the first. So I am going to give it a... what did you give it, Spencer?
3.5.
Yeah, that actually sounds about right. A 3.5 out of 5. Monocles. It is a great movie to watch if you got time. If you have Netflix, it is definitely available still there. Check it out. Watch the film. Let us know your thoughts. Drop us a line. We'd love to hear it. But that about wraps up another awesome episode of The Film Philosophers. We are so happy that you were able to join us for our first episode of 2023.
Yes.
We are excited as we got things coming down the pipeline that we are excited to share with you. And we will be dropping an episode on all of those wonderful and great things soon. This month. But of course, you can check us out over wherever podcasts are streaming, whether if it's iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, or iHeart. You can tune in to wherever your heart's desire. Find us there, The Film Philosophers. Give us a follow, give us a subscribe, listen in, let us know how we're doing. Drop us a line in the comments on that page. Also, if you think we're doing a good job, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it.
Yes.
But you can also check us out on our website at filmlosophers.com. We got everything there from romance to sleuthing and mystery.
And Paddington.
And Paddington.
Yes.
Two.
And Paddington 2, yes. Check us out at our website, filmlosophers.com. You can also check us out on the social links over at Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers or on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101. There you can check out all of our great posts, everything that we'll be showing you guys for the upcoming year. Also, that is where we will be leaving links towards Spencer's Big Scores and Amy's Jane on Scene. Amy, where can people find Jane on Scene?
The only place that she's ever lived by those dang dirty apes at Jane on Scene on Instagram. I saw Planet of the Apes. That's her.
Yeah, I got that.
Yeah.
That sounds like it's an upcoming episode. We are so excited for the new year, and we hope you are too, as new things are coming, and we're excited about new beginnings, new journeys, and new movies. So, from all of us here at the Film Philosophers, we want to wish you a happy new year, and I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
Still intern Amy.
Class dismissed.